Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We are studying the Meyer material this afternoon. I'm going to play some more clips in regards to the California wildfires. These will get progressively worse, according to the Meyer information, and will have devastating effects. They're already having devastating effects. I've got about four or five clips here. I think I'm just going to let them play and speak for themselves. So here we go.
In California, they are still trying to tackle a massive wildfire by air and by land, dousing it with water. The fire is less than 5% contained so far, and thousands of homes east of Los Angeles are still under threat. The BBC's James Cook reports.
Midday in Southern California, and the Blue Cup fire continues to rage out of control. The ground here is tinder dry from 5 years of drought. It's baking hot, and a strong breeze is fanning the flames. Conditions for the firefighters could hardly be worse.
Boy, what a big deal that is to have the southbound side of the I-15 reopen.
There was some good news today. The main route between Los Angeles and Las Vegas is open again. But driving through the desert now looks more like a journey across the surface of the moon.
Well, fires like this one are burning all up and down this mountain range, and firefighters are really struggling to keep up. Of course, it's one thing allowing them to burn in wildland like this, but the real concern here is for life and property.
In the tourist town of Wrightwood, high in the San Gabriel Mountains, these are nervous moments. Its residents have been ordered to leave, but some are staying put.
You see a lot of fire coming down the hill, and that worries me. You know, I would like to see some air support do something up there. You can hear equipment up there moving around, but I'm just hoping they get it before it gets down too close.
Some houses and businesses have burned, but there is still no detail on how many. Hundreds of homes in the high desert are without power. And this is far from the only wildfire causing problems in California. Across the state, nearly 10,000 firefighters are tackling 9 big blazes. It is an uphill battle. James Cook, BBC News, in Southern California.
East of Los Angeles, more than 1,500 firefighters are facing walls of fire 80 feet tall. Hot, dry gusts are whipping up fire tornadoes across brush, brittle from drought. It's not known how many homes in San Bernardino County were torched, but more than 80,000 people have fled their neighborhoods. Carter Evans is there.
The air assault on the most stubborn part of the fire is relentless. Drop after drop, and the flames keep coming back. Even tiny embers could be catastrophic.
You're looking at the head of the fire right now, and firefighters want to keep it on the hill here moving this direction. What they don't want it to do is jump across the road.
as we get the wind, that has potential to carry embers and unburned vegetation.
Battalion Chief Mike Brown says the fire behavior he's seen over the last few days is extraordinary.
Spotting ahead of itself by, 300 and 400 feet, fire whirls that look like tornadoes. Fire behavior that, as firefighters, we read about, we train about, but to actually see it was truly amazing.
As the Blue Cut fire roared through desert towns, residents had just minutes to flee. Hundreds of large animals were rescued and brought to this evacuation shelter. Abel Flores is still looking for his horse.
A home could be replaced, but not human life or an animal that you love.
Some normalcy has returned. Trucks are once again rolling on Interstate 15. They've been trapped since the fire began, costing up to $1 million a day in economic losses. And rail traffic is also moving again. Among the homes and buildings burned to the ground, the Summit Restaurant, an icon along Route 66, say former owners Cecil and Deborah Stevens.
We've been through a lot of storms and car accidents coming through the restaurant, but this time we didn't make it.
A lot of history here. We're told Elvis Presley and John Wayne once dined where I'm standing. As for this fire, well, the wind is beginning to pick up again, and that makes it challenging for firefighters. Scott, those hazardous red flag conditions, well, they're expected to continue into the night.
Amazing pictures of devastation. Carter, thank you very much.
This guy is out running around lighting fires.
These amazing images show a man in the middle of a brush fire, and he's suspected of having started it.
He's lit 7 different fires.
The guys who shot the video last Thursday couldn't believe what they were seeing.
We're photographing this guy lighting these fires.
The drama comes at a scary time in Southern California, with deadly wildfires raging.
It was kind of mind-blowing. It was one of those traumatic events where I don't think your mind could really process what you were witnessing.
Bernie Deo and Jeffrey Zimmerman shot the video. As flames erupt around them, they realize they are in harm's way.
We gotta go. We gotta move them.
As he started lighting fire after fire, that grass and the wind just started to carry that fire out through the rangeland.
The suspected firebug paid a price for his madness.
I think he's got serious burns.
I saw him with burns on the back, on his back and on his legs.
The suspect was tackled and charged with arson. 90 miles away outside Santa Clarita, the threat to people and property is terrifying.
The numbers are staggering. 10,000 homes have been evacuated as the flames sweep relentlessly on. That means an estimated 10,000 acres of land going up in flames every day.
Flames threaten the animal refuge run by actress Tippi Hedren, whose daughter is Melanie Griffith, and whose granddaughter is 50 Shades of Grey star Dakota Johnson. Melanie Griffith tweeted, "My mom's place is being evacuated." With scorching heat and fierce gusts of wind, these are fearful times in Southern California, which makes the actions of the accused arsonist all the more maddening.
I've never seen anything this insane in my life.
Meanwhile, out west, the explosive blue-cut wildfire is threatening more homes and people in Southern California today. This fast-moving fire has already forced around 82,000 people to evacuate areas east of Los Angeles, and it's torched more than 25,000 acres, and it's less than 5% contained.
Firefighters say the flames are unlike anything they have ever seen. Here's what one told our Carter Evans.
We had to continually retreat against that advancing wall of fire, and that was something that I haven't witnessed in this section ever. We have strike teams here, and remember, our priorities are life, property, and infrastructure. And lives also include firefighters' lives. And we can't go and stand in front of that 80-foot wall of fire. That's self-defeating.
Carter Evans is with us now from Wrightwood, California. Carter, we just heard you talking to one of the firefighters on the ground. What's the latest on the containment efforts?
Let's pan the camera so we can show you the types of flames that they're having to deal with right here. And you can see this tree just lit up right behind us. And we probably got 50-foot flame length there. I am probably, I'd say, about 75 feet away from this, and I can feel the heat from this tree right now. So this is what they're dealing with, and this was a relatively calm fire, at least here in this area. Actually, let's just stay on that for a second, because that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I think that this is really important for you to see this, because we're safe right here. But imagine trying to approach that with a hose. There's no point. A hose is not going to do anything. So you got to call in a helicopter if you want to try and put out a fire like that, or you got to decide, are you going to let it burn? Is it safe to let it burn? Is it going to start another fire? As we pan a little bit back over here, you'll see that we're on a roadway. This road is a natural fire break, and the goal right now is to keep this fire from jumping over this road. If they do that, we're in pretty good shape. We might have some more containment today. If it jumps over the road and goes off that way, we could have a whole new fire.
Well, clearly this fire has had no problem traveling. I think it's only been about a day and a half. It went from 5 acres to 25,000. How does that happen? Is the weather an issue?
You know, this fire did in 24 hours what most large fires take almost a month to do.
Wow.
And that gives you an idea of how fast this moves. I was the first day this started, I was standing down on Highway 138, and you'd see flames, I don't know, a couple hundred feet away from you, and literally a minute or two later, it's right on top of you, and you feel like you're in the middle of a hurricane with debris and ashes and soot and all sorts of embers blowing at you, and that's how this fire spreads. And that's how it spread so quickly. It spread very fast. These embers can go a mile away sometimes and start new spot fires that eventually the main fire catches up to, and that's how it creates one big, massive fire.
But, you know, Carter, often when you hear about fires traveling so rapidly, you know, maybe it's really windy out or there's, you know, the vegetation is sort of ripe for this sort of thing to happen. This is just seems so odd to me. You know, what are officials saying about why this is traveling this quickly?
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's the trifecta. You've got the hot weather. It's been triple-digit temperatures. We've had single-digit humidity, so it's extremely dry. And then 5 years of drought. So all of this vegetation that you're looking at, even the green stuff, is dry. And in many cases, it's already dead or dying. So these are perfect conditions for a wildfire like this. Then you add these red flag windy conditions, and that's how you get it moving so fast. But, you know, why?
Depressing news indeed. We're still dealing with these horrific wildfires in California. I'd almost prefer to ignore them, but that's probably not the wise thing to do either. So, but I think that's pretty much all I'm going to talk about as far as the fires this evening. It's a disturbing topic. It's something that seems not to want to go away. It's something we're going to have to continue to deal with as time goes on. I want to step back and talk about the Lyra Vegas system a little bit. Talk about also our binary star system, which is something I just learned from the Meyer information. In, you know, the Pleiadians say that our forefathers are their forefathers, and that the oldest branch of the human race originated in Lyra Vega. Well, actually, they came from other galaxies into the Lyra Vega system. And the more I study Lyra and Vega, this whole constellation of Lyra, the more interesting it becomes. Sloth even talked to Billy about the Lyra system back when Billy was much younger. He was 4 to 5 years old. It was just after World War II when his 11 years of contacts with Sloth began. The Lyrians first settled our galaxy in the constellation of Lyra, and the closest stars in that constellation are 20 to 30 light years away. But there are stars in that constellation that are hundreds and hundreds of light years from Earth. One of the most famous stars in the constellation of Lyra is called Vega. It's one of the brightest stars in our night sky, and it also forms something they call the summer triangle. One very strange thing that goes on in the Lyrian constellation are these binary stars. And a binary star are two or more stars that rotate around each other. They rotate around this common center of gravity. And there are a whole series of these close binary stars in the Lyra Vega system, and they're called the Beta Lyra variables. And the total brightness of these stars is variable because the two component stars, they orbit around each other, and they kind of block each other out depending, you know, on what angle you're looking at this from. The shapes of these stars also become heavily distorted because of these tremendous gravitational forces which take place. And sometimes these stars become ellipsoidal, in shape as massive flows go from literally one star to the other. It must be an incredible thing to see. There are also super giants which are formed, and we can talk about that a little bit later. These are really giant stars. As I said earlier, these binary stars, they rotate around each other. They have a common center of gravity called the Barry Center. They're often called double stars. As I was saying earlier, Vega is one of the brightest stars. It's relatively close to Earth, about 25 light years away. There's another very important star called Arcturus. Now, in Contact Report 214, these supergiant stars are talked about. And let me read a little bit. I think this may be Billy speaking. It says, of course, because you must be oriented over everything. But now I have a question regarding the entity, or the giant star, as is sometimes said, which is called Betelgeuse. If I remember correctly, Patel told me when he showed me the entity on my great journey in 1975 that it was about 620 times the diameter of our sun. In addition, Alnitak, which is also a star, one of these supergiants, has a luminosity 19,000 times brighter than our sun. Is this right, Billy asks, for I explain this to someone who asked me about it. Anyway, that information is correct. Betelgeuse, it's also called Alpha Orionis, is the ninth brightest star in the night sky and the second brightest star in the constellation of Orion. I also talked about yesterday the fact that our solar system is a binary star system. We have a dark star that orbits with our sun around a common center, a common Barry center. That's this other star is 10 times smaller than our sun. It has its own set of planets, and it's, I guess you could call it, its own solar system. It's sometimes referred to as the dark star in the Meyer material. It's about a little over one light year from the sun, and I'm not sure how long it takes to get around this star, how often they circle around each other. I've also in the past few days talked about the Ring Nebula, which we've discussed a little bit as well. The Ring Nebula they call the Eye of God. It was a star that was destroyed in the ancient past by an Ishwish, king of wisdom, who was not so wise in terms of the spiritual teachings, evidently. The Lyrians in Contact Report 238 are said to come from the Lyran galaxy, which dissolved itself and turned into energy. This occurred about 26 million years ago when one of the earlier personalities of Edward Albert Meyer, a man named Nocodemian, left these home worlds and came to Lyra Vega. The Lyra Vega system. And of course, as you know, the Lyra Vega system that I speak of is in a different space-time configuration than our Lyra Vega system. So there are multiple space-time configurations for our universe. There's at least three. They won't tell us how many. It's something that I think we only have a very basic or partial understanding of. The first emigration of Nocodemian took place about 110 million years ago, where these people who are what we would call the Lyrians came from a galaxy called the Nagaran Galaxy. It's described in Contact 248. And they came from a planet named Kados. So the Lyrians started in the Nagaran Galaxy. They must have went to the Lyran Galaxy. The Lyran Galaxy also died. Then they moved to Lyra Vega, an older space-time configuration version of the Lyra Vega system. And that's where Nocodemian taught. Now, Billy was interviewed in 1988, and he discussed the Lyra Vega, the Lyrians and Vegans. And he explains that the Plaiarn were not the first extraterrestrials to come to the Earth, but these Lyrians and Vegans did some 22 million years ago. Their stay here was very brief, and they continued onward to travel to other star systems. About 389,000 years ago, several million of these Lyrians and Vegans, they left their native world. They entered our space-time dimension. They came to the Earth, and they mingled with the people of the Earth. There were genetic engineering that was also done. Normal intercourse and offspring were produced. Part human, part animal, because of the genetic engineering. There were also giants, titans, other creatures that were formed. After hundreds of thousands of years, all of these creatures died out. The Lyrians were of great power and fighting efficiency, and they would often conquer worlds very quickly. They also came under the influence of the Destroyer Comet, which wiped out two-thirds of their civilization in the ancient past. And the Lyrians would rise to very high levels and often war among themselves and destroy themselves. At some point, about 144,000 of these Lyrians escaped wars in the Lyrian constellation, and they set up a colony on Earth. These individuals were rather degenerate, and they abused the native Earth people. They mated them with animals. They raped and disfigured them. And eventually their crimes got back to the Lyrian worlds. The Lyrian homeworld sent fleets of ships, and they basically punished these 144,000 by stranding them here, taking away their technology. So they eventually died on Earth and became part of the reincarnational patterns of Earth. And I bet they feel very strange here after being in a much more advanced society. Anyway, the term Ishwish is another important thing to keep in mind. And the term means what we would call king of wisdom. And sometimes it was given the acronym IHWH. And even on the Lyrian homeworlds, these Ishwish leaders sometimes ruled with a cruel power. And there would be wars that would break out on the Lyrian homeworlds. And we know that for certain. And we can see the Ring Nebula is the result of one of these wars. That's where one of these Ishwishes destroyed a star. And there are other stories that talk about three worlds of the Lyra system, which was eliminated and dissolved into energy. But about 230,000 years ago, there was a king of wisdom called Asael, who left Lyra Vega and took with him a whole series of peoples, thousands of peoples. They took something like 183 great spacer ships and about 250 smaller ships, and they wandered around the cosmos for a while. And eventually, they came to the Plaiarn system, and they settled on the planet Era. Now, Era is in another dimension. It's in a different space-time configuration. It's about 500 light years from Earth. It's the homeworld of Ptah, Quetzal, Semyase, Sfath. and about 500 million other human beings from the Pleiaren Federation. Their economy is non-monetary. It's robot-assisted manufacturing. They have a borrowed asset scheme. If you need a flying car, you can get one. Poverty has been eradicated. Food, energy, and housing are free. They have both polygamy and monogamy. Very seldom do they have homosexuality. They say they can correct that fairly easily. It's a natural genetic disorder that happens occasionally. When the leader Asael died, he was succeeded by his daughter Plagia, and the home system, originally the Pleiaren system, was called the Asael system, and then when his daughter took over, it was called the Plagia system. Plagia was the daughter of Asael. She rediscovered Earth, Mars, and Melona, and she took her ships, and they followed the tail of the destroyer comet, and they followed it into the Sol system. And when they got here to Earth, they noticed that there were white people here. And these people were the descendants of the original 144,000 who came from Lyra Vega. And the people of Plagia's group were able to detect the Lyrian spirit forms of these colonists who had degenerated in a very short time into very primitive people. Again, I would think this would be very strange, very uncomfortable situation for older spirit forms. Melona, we've talked about Melona before. Melona was a planet in our solar system that had life, all kinds of life, all the normal plant, animal, and human life on it, as did Mars. But it was populated by a people that are called the genetically manipulated people, which are kind of our ancestors, who had the shortened lifespans and the intensified aggression. They destroyed their planet in a huge explosion. Shortly after Melona was destroyed, the Pleiaren had their own problems. They left our system. They left Mars. They left Melona. And they left Earth. And this was, I think, about 58,000 years ago, something like that, probably even longer. Some of the dates on some of the Meyer material, I haven't gotten corrected dates. We've talked about the civilization of Pelagon and how it advanced on Earth. This was Pelagon was about 150,000 years ago. And I don't know the exact date of the destruction of Melona, but I think it was more recent than that. The people in Pelagon society settled the earth, and they had a wonderful civilization for many, many years. And when another Ishwish took over, named Jazas, when Pelagon died, Jazas was a cruel tyrant. And there was a great war that really devastated the earth. Most of the people that left the earth went to Beta Centauri, which is hundreds of light years away. And also they went to a close-by star called the Barnard Star, which is a low-mass red dwarf. It's about 6 light years from Earth. Just a word about the Beta Centauri system. It's very far away. And it shouldn't be confused with Alpha Centauri, especially with Alpha Centauri B. The Alpha Centauri is very close. It's only about 4 light years, I think, from the Earth. Alpha Centauri A has about 110% of the mass of our sun. It's about 1.5 times brighter. Alpha Centauri B is 90% of the mass of our sun. There is an Earth-sized planet rotating around Alpha Centauri B, It's the closest exoplanet to Earth. The official announcement of the existence of this exoplanet was only in 2012. It was discovered by the observatory in Geneva, which I believe is in Switzerland. And they consider this planet that it might be a twin Earth. The third star in the Alpha Centauri system is the Proxima Centauri system. So many times there's a binary star system out there. You know, our solar system is a binary star system. We don't know that yet. What is the Barnard star? I talked briefly about the Barnard star. The Barnard star is a low-density brown dwarf star. It's pretty close to the Earth. It's too dim to be seen with the naked eye. And our dark twin, our binary star system, is also a dark star that can't be seen with the naked eye. So we live in a binary system as well. And I've talked about the ancient past here before. I've talked about Hyperborea and how the Hyperborea was actually in the North Pole. About 113,000 years ago or so, it was extremely warm. There was something fundamentally different about our climate. I'm going to have to hopefully learn that someday. And it's very interesting that these extraterrestrials that came during the time of Atlantis and Lemuria came from Beta Centauri. Now, Beta Centauri is like 350 light years from Earth. This is where Eris the Barbarian came from. And there are some interesting Arabic terms to describe Beta Centauri. Hadar is one of them. Hadar comes from the Arabic root, which means to be present on the ground, to be civilized. So I always ask the question, why would an ancient people refer to a star system using the term that means on the ground unless visitors actually came from there and settled? So again, back to the idea of Hyperborea, Florida was actually located in the North Pole area. This was called Hyperborea at that time. The forces of Eris the Barbarian, who came from Beta Centauri, conquered Hyperborea in ancient times. The sons of Eris existed on the Earth for many centuries. The country of India today was at one time called Aryan because it was named after Eris the Second, one of the sons of Eris the Barbarian. There was a whole lineage of Eris the Barbarians. In fact, Eris the 11th was murdered thousands of years later by his third-born son called Jehovan. Jehovan is mentioned in Contact Report 70 as one of the rulers in the line of the Giza intelligences. Now, as far as I can tell, the destruction of Atlantis and Lemuria, the final destruction, I think was 11,500 years ago. I hope somebody someday can confirm or deny that for me. During that time, Jehovan took over command of the Hyperborea. He took over the descendants of Armus. He took over the descendants of the Aryans and the Hebrons. Just as a side note, in Mount Shasta, there exists a small city of about 700 people, and these people are called the Hyperboreans. They are the leftover descendants of a group of extraterrestrials that lived on the Earth in the ancient past. They'd been here like 180,000 years. I don't even know if you should call them extraterrestrials after they lived here almost 200,000 years. But you can see, and there are photographs of their golden-colored spherical spacecrafts coming out of Mount Shasta. And they're sometimes seen at other locations like Mount Mammoth. And there's a very interesting photograph of one of these ships, which I think I've showed before, and I'll put this URL in the chat room, and you guys can see if you can get to that URL and see the interesting picture of one of these spacecraft. It looks like a tiny dot in the sky, and then when you get close to it, you can really look close and see these crafts. They're really bizarre. Now, these people, these Hyperboreans, had a city found very deep in the center of Mount Shasta, and its entrance was camouflaged very well on the eastern mountain peak. And the Hyperboreans, at times, they would get visits from people of other worlds as well. The Hyperboreans also had a group of people that were living underground near the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. The Hyperboreans also were involved in other historical events. There was a king of wisdom who was one of the Hyperboreans, who commissioned Noah to build the ark and who gave Henoch his great wisdom. During the time of Henoch, like I had said earlier, in Contact Report 39, it explains that the polar regions were wondrous landscapes. They were filled with palm trees, tropical vegetation. It was like a paradise on Earth. Contact Report 70 talks about some of this. Now, Noah, Billy has said before, Noah's real name was Noah Codnesser, and he was almost 10 feet tall, which is incredible. Semyasi told Billy that Noah was not actually the one that ended up building the ark. So, and I never got that information. I don't know if Noah didn't actually build the ark. Who did? I'm not sure. I thought he played a role in that. Anyway, this occurred about 100,000 years ago, and according to Quetzal, the ark landed about 5,000 meters high up on Mount Ararat. And the size of the ark also corresponds to what's described in our Bible. It is correct. If you want to read more about this, you can go to Contact Report 150. Which I can throw that link in the chat room. Contact Report 150 is absolutely a big contact. It's gigantic. Something I could certainly read again. This story about Noah Codnesser is also talked about in Contact Report 248, which I will dump in the chat room. So you guys can look at that at your leisure. In any case, as you know, and I've talked at great length before about Atlantis and Lemuria, and so I won't cover that again, but maybe someday we'll come back to that as well. And the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria and the Great Pyramids. I wanted to... Maybe I'll go ahead and talk a little bit about something that's talked about in Contact Report 544, where we talk about the Neanderthals. So this is there's a lot of strange stuff that's gone on the Earth. Now, the Neanderthals were early humans, as were Homo sapiens. What happened, the Neanderthals were very large. They had evolved to handle cold weather. They hunted prey in deeply dark forested areas, in very dense forested areas. They didn't move so well in the open. They weren't so fast in the open. So the Neanderthals became vulnerable to the Homo sapiens at this time. And so you could say we were killing the Neanderthals, believe it or not. And it says on page 6 in Contact Report 544, as a rule, the modern human beings hunted the Neanderthals and killed them to use them as food because the early Homo sapiens were cannibals. Isn't that nice? Nice to know where we came from. And as such, they by and by wiped out the Neanderthals. Partly, the modern humans held Neanderthals as captive, which they killed and ate in case of need for food. So maybe the Neanderthals were our first domesticated animals. Anyway, additionally, Billy had some other questions that he wanted to ask Ptah in relation to the Neanderthals. And as I explained here, well, let me read this here. The Neanderthals, but also for their final demise, anatomic influences as well as natural catastrophic climatic influences existed, which I've never named. The Neanderthals were hunted down again by the modern humans and used as food. However, in addition to cannibalism of the Neanderthals, there were sexual acts between the Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. So there were offspring, there were Neanderthal human hybrids, and some of the genetics of the Neanderthals are still in us. At this time also, strong climatic changes were occurring, which had a negative impact on the food supply of the Neanderthals. Their diet consisted primarily of meat, but they were not good hunters in the open areas as the forests became less dense and had more open areas. They could be outrun by animals easier, so they didn't do as well. They also had a poor ability to digest their food, so they needed mass quantities of food to survive, which became harder and harder for them. These changes occurred about 45,000 years ago. Now, what's weird and bizarre about this, 45,000 years ago, that would have, I think, been the time. There were extraterrestrial humans on the Earth at this time. So we had a very strange history of the Earth. I haven't pieced it all together yet. The emerging climate all altered the forests and the landscapes as well. There became these big open spaces, as I described earlier, where the Neanderthals couldn't hunt well. So they used to hunt in the heavy forests and they didn't do as well in the open plains. So that's one of the interesting things of our past. The Neanderthals slowly then were kind of absorbed by humans, you know, in one way or another, depending on how you look at that. They became sex objects, and they also became used for food. So the Neanderthals, another interesting thing about the Neanderthals, they had a very large skull, which made birth very difficult. And females often died in childbirth because of the very, very large skulls of their offspring. So anyway, a little side information about the Neanderthals and the strange history that we have in regard to them. And contact report 544 is all over the place. It talks again. Yesterday we talked about the seven major forces of nature, and only four of those are known to our scientists. We talked about the risk of the breakdown of the global ocean conveyor belt. That's one of the things that is occurring during what the Meyer material calls global warming, is that the mixing of the waters of our oceans is not occurring as it should. And if this completely stops, it says on one, and I read it again today, says that we'll have the total extinction of all life on Earth, which I just can't even wrap my mind around. We talked about the soul star, our dark twin, which is about one light year away. Hence, we have a binary system. This dark twin, it affects our Oort cloud. It pulls in other meteors out of the Oort cloud and brings them into places that can harm Earth. The next area of this contact report, if we go into it, talks about the actions of some of our presidents. Some of the actions of Bush, the Meyer material is not very complimentary of Bush. The Meyer material says that Bush, the younger Bush, is not so bright, which is a common thing that's said among people today. I think we may go over this in the future. I never know exactly where we're going to be led as we study this material. There seems to be a invisible hand pushing us in certain directions and away from certain things at certain times and back to other places. So in any case, some interesting information from Contact Report 544. As you know, I talked about the fires a little bit earlier. I want to go back to our book, The Way to Live. And we've been talking about striving, a creational natural law, which exists today. There's something called the absolute absolutum, which the Meyer material talks about. I've heard it said that there are 10 to the 49th power different forms of creation. I've heard it said that there are 1,049 different forms of creation. I'm not sure exactly how many forms there are, but our universe is in the first stage of its evolvement. What the Meyer material explains is that there's an intelligence which runs our universe. It's evolving. It's not a God. It's not a Heavenly Father. It's not perfect. It's not immutable. It isn't omnipotent. It isn't omniscient. But it has an incredible intelligence. It expresses its love through the appearance of its creation, the visible expression of its love, the incredible splendor of nature, the visible expression of love of creation. Creation is a neutral positive entity. It's not a Heavenly Father. It behaves according to certain creational natural laws. Our universe functions on these creational natural laws. It's very different from what Billy calls the irrational teachings of our religion. And let me read what it says here in terms of Buddhism. Very often, as it is with Buddhism, the physical life is portrayed as suffering, which is also expressed in the Buddhist proverb, which says, patiently I wear out my body. Aging and life are supposed to be suffering, the religion of Buddhism asserts. Life is the fulfillment of the divine determinations through sin and atonement, asserts another religion. In addition to that, there are still coming the remaining religions and the innumerable sects, which among the human beings on the entire globe cause their mischief, spread wrong philosophies, and bombard human beings and guide them into unreal, often hair-raisingly contradictory dogmas and fraudulent teachings. I was thinking about that today because, for example, the Christian religion would say the Bible is the Word of God. You can point out many things in the Bible, both in the Old and the New Testament, that seems very strange and very odd. And I point them out many times. But another thing that you might consider, if you had an intelligence, a super intelligence, let's say like the universal consciousness, how could it ever express itself through our languages? I doubt that it could. To me, that would be like trying to tell someone how to build the space shuttle with dog barks or chicken squawks. I don't think that that's possible. I don't think it's possible for a superintelligence like the creation to really put its ideas and thoughts accurately in human words. So I think here on the earth, we have a strange perspective, almost a feeble-mindedness in terms of our perspective. Let me read what Billy says here. There's just so much here. Let me start here. What purely human feeble-mindedness, because aging means evolving and death, means the evolution and the transition to a new life, and thereby to new striving. Death means continued existence in new powerful life, the sense of which in turn lies in the striving for that which is higher, for the highest possible relatively absolute fulfillment. So even as we die and move into the spiritual realm, our spirit form and our consciousness, that's another time to strive. It's only the end of the physical body, but we'll get a new one. While we're striving, that is, we're fulfilling a creational principle of evolution. So death means life, and therefore it does not require any dogmas pertaining to death and survival. Indeed, the truth is much simpler than human brains have thought up and dreamed up. So many of the religions have thought up these erroneous teachings, which have led us down the wrong path. And Billy states here that every rational individual is born in order to evolve, compelled and driven by the creational impulse of striving for that which is higher. So that's one of the creational natural laws, that everything has to strive to live. And one day, after 40 to 60 million years, another evolution takes place where we lose the need for the physical body. And the body starts its transition into a spirit form again. So, as Emmanuel said, the body is a part of the spirit. They're not a duality. They're one. The body comes from the spirit. This is a very strange thing for us to wrap our mind around, that everything physical comes from the spiritual, but our scientists rule out the spiritual. They don't even think about that. So life and death are an unstoppable striving for constantly new life and for that which is higher, that which is more fully developed. That is what is happening. That is the truth of striving. What does Billy say here? In the progress of which there is never an end and never can be an end, because the evolution progresses incessantly and never finds an end, even in the highest of all, that which is highest, and in the most absolutely fully developed of all, that which is most absolutely fully developed. And it also never finds an end in the absolute absolutum, which we talked about before. Remember, our universe is in the first stage of its evolution. It's 46 trillion years old. It was created 46 trillion years ago. There was a big bang, so to speak, that created our universe and our sister universe, the Tao universe. And we live in a material universe. And after this universe expands for hundreds of trillions of years, and then it contracts for hundreds of trillions of years, it will go into a dormant state. And then it's in its second stage, it will go into a stage of existence which is not material. And again, that is very strange, very hard for us to wrap our minds. So the truth of the matter is that we have the becoming and the passing, and the becoming again, in the form that every single existence and every single creation evolves, striving forward such that by means of passing, everything forms into new life. It's constantly repeating new becoming after the passing. Therefore, the becoming follows the passing, and change follows the change toward the constantly new and higher life. This is the endless evolution, and this is not what's taught by our religions. So this is the cycle, the reincarnational pattern of life, and the laws of striving. Anyway, I really appreciated talking to you guys this evening. It's always fun. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back Wednesday, and we're going to talk with Sheldon Neidel. That's Wednesday, August 24th, 8 to 9 p.m., and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.